Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are two sides to every person's story. Take Denise, for example. In a new book about women in prison, you can see her as a former crack addict, a stripper, a woman arrested and convicted who still doesn't even think she belongs behind bars. But there is another side. Denise is also an abused woman, a person without many choices in life who makes a couple of bad ones, and then finds herself as a mother behind bars serving 5 years with minimal access to her 9-year-old son. Christina Rathbone is a writer who makes it her business to find out about people. She did it in an earlier book, spending a year in an inner-city high school. She tried to do it this time in a story about the lives of women who live behind bars. Well, the Massachusetts Department of Corrections did its level best to thwart her efforts, limiting her access over a 4-year period it took her to do the work. Nevertheless, Christina still managed to write a story about the lives of women behind bars. It's called A World Apart. Now, some of her questions are simple and straightforward, and we'd like to hear from you on them. Should women get the same treatment in prison as men? I mean, both men and women are separated from their children when they go to jail, but should the women as mothers have any better access to those kids? Should the government make it any easier for reporters and writers to find out what goes on inside prison? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Christina Rathbone is here with me in the studio. Her book is called A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. Thanks for coming in. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
I don't normally begin by talking about numbers, but some of the statistics that you used to set the scene here made it easier for me to understand what's going on. And the one that stuck in my head more than anything else, Christina, was that over the... Now, you're going to help me with this, but over the recent years, there have been more women in percentage terms put in jail than men?
That's right. The prison population has been skyrocketing, of course, over the past 2 decades. We now have more than 2 million people behind bars in the country as a whole. But while the male population has doubled in that same period of time, the number of women in prison has increased by 5 times. So they are the fastest growing group of inmates in the country
today. Do we have any simple explanation for that? Any way of knowing why that's the case?
You know, the war on drugs has been responsible for most of the increase in prison population, male and female, and certainly the numbers of women that have been put in prison under the mandatory drug sentencing laws have just skyrocketed, and that's largely responsible for that increase.
You also come across a distinction between men in prison and women in prison when it comes to violence, because violence seems to be so much more a part of the charge and the conviction and the life in prison for men than it is for women.
That's right. Today in Massachusetts, I think it's about 2/3 of women in MCI Framingham are nonviolent criminals sentenced for nonviolent behavioral crimes. And it's the flip side for men. So about 2/3 are violent for men. So a very different scenario. And it's historically always been that way. Women from the beginning have been sent to prison for things that men generally aren't.
In fact, when you do some of the history here, it's remarkable how little has changed. When you go back like 130 years to the start of MCI Framingham, we're seeing then women who are locked up for lewdness or drunkenness or homelessness. And I'm reading this part of the history and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but that was then. And then get to your own study of the women who are there right now. And so many of those things are similar.
It's amazing. You know, back 130, 150 years ago, you could be put in prison for things you can't, thankfully, today, like being a disobedient wife or a disobedient daughter, even. These were crimes back then for women, not for men. But today, though you could take a quick glimpse and say, oh, how different these women are, they're very much the same women. Back then, they were almost all first-generation immigrants, almost all Irish, almost all poor, almost all with very little education and very few opportunities. And today, it's the same. It's the outcast, it's the underprivileged, it's the poor, it's the minorities that are in prison. And again, they're still serving time for nonviolent offenses.
Where did you come down on this idea of mothers behind bars? Did you conclude at the end of all the interviews and all the time that you spent with the women that, in fact, mothers as parents deserve something different from fathers as parents when it comes to access to their children?
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I've never looked at it in that way before. I think the critical distinction is not the parent or non-parent, but rather the primary caregiver or the non-primary caregiver. In most cases, it's still true in society today that women are the primary caregivers of children. Certainly, it's the case with women in prison. Men who go to prison tend not to be the primary caretakers of their children. So when they go away, their children's lives are clearly impacted, but they remain with their mother, and they're often brought on a fairly regular basis to visit with their fathers by the mother. When a woman and a mother goes to prison, the children often are left without any caretaker at all, and that's the key difference, because then about half of those kids go to foster care system and about half of them go to live with their grandmothers, of course already overburdened women themselves. And so that is the thing that then perpetuates a whole other generation of trouble, a whole other generation of criminal justice involvement, and that's where the real danger lies.
Let's talk about Denise, and I guess I should make the point that or maybe you can help me with this. At the end of the book, the names all then appear in quotes. That means that none of the names are their real names?
Right. And at the beginning, too, I make it clear that the contemporary women's names have all been changed. The historical women's names remain the same as long as they're long enough ago. I felt it very important to maintain anonymity when you're dealing with such intimate personal stories that involve criminal justice issues.
Denise is the woman that I talked about at the very beginning of the program, and she seems to me to be this kind of excellent example of the kind of person who both deserves to be in jail and then doesn't deserve to be in jail, certainly not under the circumstances. Is it your conclusion as well?
Yeah, in all the time that I spent in Framingham meeting with women, I only ever met one person who said that she didn't do the crime. Everybody else acknowledged that their lives were going off on a wrong track, and certainly Denise never claimed innocence. Her life had gone askew. She was married to a man and who didn't treat her or her son well. She finally got the strength to leave him after having suffered through many violent episodes. Worked then as an exotic dancer, and became addicted to drugs, as so many people in society do today. She was never out on the street. She was always a relatively functioning woman, but she was a crack addict nonetheless, and that soon led to her arrest for a drug crime.
And you say that she went to prison sort of wondering why she was there nonetheless.
Yeah, like many of us, this was her first time offense, so she had no relationship and no knowledge of the criminal justice system any more than anybody else who's never been arrested. So she, in her mind, had this idea of what it would be like to be in prison, this terrifying, scary place like you see on TV with these predatory women. And she was very surprised when she arrived that it wasn't like that at all, that many of the women were similar to many of the women she'd known through different phases of her life. But she did, to begin with, still maintain the idea that she didn't belong there, that it's very hard to shed a whole identity instantaneously, to go from being a mother, someone who works, someone who pays the bills, someone who keeps life together, to being basically like a child with no responsibilities and no freedom whatsoever. And it takes time to accept the reality of your life in prison. And it's that process of accepting the fact that you're in prison that then goes on to dictate, I believe, how you fare in prison.
Now, somebody's going to be listening to this description of Denise and thinking to themselves, you know what, though, Christina, the woman did the crime. The woman ought to go to jail.
Yeah, and that's certainly many people's point of view. I think that when you're dealing with a drug addict whose crime has come almost entirely from the fact that they're a drug addict, I think it's, even from the most pragmatic point of view, wrong-headed to send them to very expensive prison for a very long time, 5 years, also to deal with the additional costs, financial as well as emotional and psychological, of the impact on the children, when you would just be much better served to send that woman to a drug rehabilitation program and actually help her solve her problem and maintain contact with her child and prevent problems that will come up.
Let's talk about her son, Patrick, because it's her access or her trying to keep track of her son while she's in prison, which illustrates part of what you were talking about earlier, this perpetuation of people going to prison because others have been sent to prison.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that there's a certain logic that propels people's lives. All of our lives have a certain coherence. And the same is true for someone like Denise's son, Patrick, who I call him Patrick in the book. He was 9 when Denise was sent away. He was a 9-year-old boy who loved Beanie Babies. He loved sports. He's a very athletic child. 5 years, a person could say, that's not long. 5 years sounds like a reasonable sentence in prison, but 5 years can really impact a 9-year-old's life. By the time Denise was released 5 years later, Patrick had had a really hard time. He'd been unprotected, and he'd had a hard time with his father, and then he had a hard time in a number of foster homes. And so the terrible irony of when Denise was released from prison, her son was in a juvenile detention center for stealing from a store. So for shoplifting, if you're a ward of the state and you shoplift, you go to prison. If you're living in your parents' home and you shoplift, your parents make sure that you get a serious warning. And I remember my own childhood, my little brother, my mother took him to the police station and terrified the wits out of him. But if you're a ward of the state, you just go to prison.
Did the time that you spent with the women change your mind about the effectiveness of the prison system? Or did you sort of go into it pretty suspicious to begin with?
I actually went into it embarrassingly, rather naively. I didn't know much about the criminal justice system. My interest about it had come not from an inherent interest in the criminal justice system, but from the book I wrote before about teenagers, many of whom were headed in that direction. So I didn't come in with any preordained political ideology that I wanted or needed to prove. And I'm very much interested in stories of people, too. So it was in that way that I approached the whole thing.
And Connection listeners, when we come back after the break, more stories about the women who are behind bars, but also a chance for you to join us on women's prisons. Should they be run just the same as men's prison? Are these criminals people who deserve to be locked away? Is that the way society works, or should things change? Time for a little more reform or a little more retrenchment? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Christina Rathbone is here with me in the studio. We're talking about her new book, A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. And it takes us about as close as we can possibly get to what it's like inside a woman's prison, simply because the Department of Corrections chose not to give Christina the kind of access that reporters or writers would expect in doing this kind of story. We'd like to have you join us as you listen in on their lives. It's actually quite remarkable, Christina, that you get to some of the detail that you do despite all this. I'm thinking of, was it Denise who desperately wanted floss for her teeth and wound up winding up garbage bags to do that?
Yeah, Denise cares a lot about her teeth, and it was a main issue for her, and it was what she sort of focused on to get through prison life, actually.
The pursuit of a real toothbrush. I mean, who knew?
That's right.
Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you join us. I thought, as we were talking earlier about Denise and the relationship with her son, Patrick, it might be interesting to hear a short passage from the book. Now, this is a scene, help me with this, Christina, when Denise kind of gets a surprise announcement from the prison that her son is there. How long has it been at this point since she's seen him? It's like 2 years or something?
I think it's 2.5 years since she's seen him. Yeah, and at this point she's been transferred to the then minimum security facility, MCI Lancaster, which has since been closed down.
And all we know about this point is that her son Patrick was out in Hawaii living with an abusive father, was then brought back, ended up in foster home, but she can never get a call from him, right?
No, you can only make collect calls out from prison, so she can never call him. And at this point when he arrives, she was convinced he was still in Hawaii, so she was really sideswiped.
Let's hear this little part of the book.
So she's told that she's walking to the dining hall, and she's told by a correction officer that though he was let in this time without his correct papers, her son would not be let in next time. And Denise panicked. Imagine not having seen your child for 2.5 years. So Denise panicked. She wanted to walk back to the women's house. She wanted to run up the hill. She wanted to throw up. Then she decided that there'd been a mistake. Pat couldn't really be there. It was impossible. Perhaps he was just on the phone. With help from the other women, she walked shakily to the chow hall and saw her father through a window. He was alone. Yes, Pat must have called from someplace else. She pulled open the heavy wooden door, and that was when she saw him, her son, Pat, grown but otherwise the same, hunched over a bag of unopened chips in the corner. Denise doesn't remember this, but her father told her later that she ran over and grabbed Patrick, sobbing, almost unable to breathe. Pat burst into tears too and clung to her. Across the room, her father started to cry. The officer in charge of the visiting room that night started to cry, and one by one, the inmates and even their visitors started to cry along with them. Through it all Denise could think to say was, "I can't believe you're here. I can't believe it." "I ran out of words quick," she told me later, "but they will come." And just holding each other, the naturalness of that was so great. It was as if the past 2 years had never been missing. He was so beautiful. Taller, but what a gorgeous, sweet kid. So gentle and grown up, yet still my pumpkin, still my baby. "Phew, Pat," I kept saying, "I can't believe I'm seeing you tonight. I never even could have imagined it. Wow, I'm still in shock, still kind of numb. He has such old, gentle eyes, and he played with my hair. His hands were bigger, but still a little like a child's, and the same with his face, and we hugged and held hands and clung to each other. I am so happy. I was beginning to think that I'd never see him again." When I came back, the whole house, most of it anyway, was ecstatic. 5 girls were waiting to talk to me, and one really hugged me, just hugged and hugged me and cried. Some of these women really are good people. I love Patrick so much. I pray for the day we can have a trailer visit. God, thank you.
That's Christina Rathbone reading from her new book, A World Apart, Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're taking a call from Newburyport, Massachusetts, and Francesca is with us. Hi, Francesca.
Good morning, Dick. Hi, Christina.
Hello.
That was beautiful. What an incredible passage that was. I wanted to call because I actually am a volunteer with Parents Helping Parents, and I facilitate a parenting support group in the Women's Pre-Release Program. Mm. And so I have an opportunity to hear those stories regularly, and I feel honored to be able to be there with these women and talk about these stories and help support them, you know, with their parenting issues. And to answer the question, should the women's situation be different from the men? Absolutely. And as Christina mentioned, the women are primary caregivers. Our culture supports mothers to be the primary caregivers and to take the children away and to not allow visits, phone calls. It perpetuates the whole cycle of incarceration, as Christina pointed out with the story of Patrick.
How do you do it, though, Francesca, if the mother is a drug addict or the mother is mentally ill? There's a high percentage of women, right, who fit both those categories.
Well, yes, and I have to say the women that I see in the program, we don't talk about why they're there, but I can gather from their stories that probably just about all of them have substance abuse issues. And they do get really good support, and there's good programs, but I agree again with Christina that let's skip over the jail. Let's skip jail. Absolutely. People need to take responsibility, and that's a really important part of what the women need to learn, is to take responsibility for their actions and to understand that part of it. But I think that more healing can come through a different type of program that's not so punitive.
But Christina, your experience at MCI Framingham is that there really aren't great programs for the women, either in terms of helping them get off drugs or helping them find, you know, college courses or any of the other things that you know, we like to think can happen inside a prison.
Yeah, sometimes we like to think it can happen, and sometimes we like to insist that it cannot. And I think it depends what political environment we're in at any given time. And so there's a tremendous amount of luck and unluck about when you're incarcerated. If you were incarcerated 3 years ago, there was very little hope that you were going to get any programming. Programs that existed were slashed with every budget cut, and the emphasis was very firmly on punishment. You were sent to prison and you were punished, and that was that. Now I think that we're beginning to move again into a time where the emphasis, certainly the Department of Corrections is asserting that the emphasis is once again on reform to reduce recidivism and to help people enter back into society successfully.
Is there proof or evidence of that, or is it talk at this point?
It's still talk, but then there hasn't been time for there to be anything much more than talk. Certain things have been done under the new commissioner, Kathleen Dennehy, and she very strongly asserts her desire to do more. And time will tell, but certainly programs are starting to be added back at MCI Framingham slowly. They've promised the addition of more programs coming in the fall, and I think if we keep up sufficient pressure and sufficient interest, and if there's enough openness for people to actually see whether these things happen or not, then I believe there's a good chance that it will.
And part of the openness, part of knowing what's going on behind the prison is a part of that change, I think, is one of the conclusions that you end up with as well.
Yeah, I think any time you have an organization that is closed, hermetically sealed, it's a recipe for disaster. And I think the more openness there is, both in terms of the media and in terms of the general public, not just randomly, but in an advisory council way, then the better it's going to be for everyone, including the taxpayers. At the moment, we have very little idea how our tens of millions of dollars are being spent every year. So even, again, from the most pragmatic point of view, it's just going to be beneficial to have more openness, more transparency.
1-800-423-8255, next to Rockland, Massachusetts, and Richard's joining us. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
It's interesting. The prior conversation today was about the gulag notion with Guantanamo and so forth. I was just catching bits and pieces as I was working.
We have switched topics. You realize that?
Yes, I do. But I think that there's a mini gulag that's going on here, and I want to make sure that Christine is not bifurcating the situation. There are any number of men that love their children deeply and are great fathers. And the corrections, I'll call it the Corrections Institute, actually is disserving both women and men. And what's happening, as I see it, is that the interface between the courts and probation departments and parole and the Department of Corrections is about rough justice. And it's not about treating people with depression and bipolar disorder and all sorts of medical problems that pervade people and cause them to be addicts and alcoholics. There's no focus on rectifying people's lives. It's about punishment. And as long as we perpetuate this theme, there'll be no resolve. We'll go nowhere. And if you take a hard look at things like motions to revise and revoke in criminal situations or any kind of number of efforts to get proper medical treatment for prisoners, even the courts are woefully inadequate when they interface with the Department of Corrections because it's a beast unto itself. And that is the misty fog that has to be lifted. That's the ghost-like quality of the Department of Corrections has to be brought to the surface, and the transparency has to be made.
Richard, just hang on with me here. Christina's nodding. I wanted to let you in, Christina.
Yeah, Richard, I was nodding vigorously because I agree with everything that you've been saying, and I certainly don't want to be insinuating that men have a great time in prison and that the programs are there. Of course, men have a terrible time, and the Department of Corrections has the same policy towards men as towards women. So when they're being punitive to women, they're being punitive to men. I do think it's important, though, that women have been so overlooked, and all I'm trying to do is bring women back up to the same level as men, but in no way am I suggesting that life is rosy for men in prison. And I wanted to also agree with you about the importance of this transparency, that I believe should be the first thing to change, not the last, because without the transparency, we don't know anything else that goes on. And there's been a movement afoot in the State House here, headed by Kay Khan, Representative Kay Khan, to institute an advisory council on a permanent basis, and that has stalled every time it's come up for a vote. And I think that it's really time for people to look at that and move forward on that. We have a temporary advisory council now, but I believe their mandate expires in December. And for that to be made permanent and to include members from different branches of government as well as inside the DOC and outside the DOC would be a huge step towards correcting a lot of wrongs, I believe.
Richard, back to you. Do you bring a sort of professional interest in this as well?
Well, I'm not a criminal attorney. I'm an attorney. But I've been in prisons and helping clients, and I've worked through that sordid situation over the years. But I think I find what's so pernicious in our society today is that on a voice vote, virtually, we spend $200 billion in Iraq, and I don't want to go there. But I find it very stubbornly difficult in my mind as to how we can just spend $200 billion. Yeah, we can't seem to detox people and find a rehabilitation facility for them, because then what they do is they just begin drinking or drugging again. So we have this craziness in our society where we all know that you detox people, then you try to rehabilitate them. And ultimately it does work. But the system breaks down constantly, consistently throughout the country. And our leaders do absolutely nothing about it. And then they wonder why. I think a lot of it's driven by money. I see the Bush folks and people like that of that ilk that are trying to privatize everything. It's about money. And privatization is not the route to go. What they have to do is try to figure out the system and medically intervene. These prisoners, both female and male, they are not getting adequate medical treatment and particularly psychological treatment that could hopefully rid them of these demons that possess them.
There's
so they can move forward with their lives.
There's a scene in Christina's book that takes us back to, what, almost 70, more than 70 years, to Miriam Van Waters. Did I get her name right?
Yeah, Miriam Van Waters.
Who takes over MCI Framingham in 1932 and does something back then that I wouldn't have thought prisons were doing. Can you just describe the changes that she brought to that prison?
Miriam Van Waters was an extraordinary woman whose passion it was to work with the reformation of women and girls. She took over Framingham in 1932, as you said. It was already stepping towards reform then. Her predecessor, Jessie Hodder, had made great strides. But she was just an inspired woman, and she made MCI Framingham a place of reform and healing. She brought in volunteers and teachers to begin just the vast array of opportunities for women to learn everything from public speaking to journalism to theatrical troupes to singing choirs to farming to woodworking to hiking groups, everything you can imagine. Of course, also serious job training programs, educational opportunities. Half of the women in Framingham were enrolled in university courses about 10 years after she took over. She made it a place where growth and healing could take place, and therefore a place which women left whole and able to reunite with their children and able to seek, find, and maintain employment, and where holistic growth was taking place. However, this had happened before. She wasn't the first reformer to do this. And as had happened before, there was a backlash to this kind of successful reform. People look at these prisons and they see them as these wonderful places of healing and community. And they get scared that if prisons become
summer camps,
what will happen to society? And so then the programs are closed down, the barbed wire is increased, and we go swing right back into the punitive mode.
Well, Richard was talking about cycles, and you talk about it as well in the book, that your is it a suspicion, Christina, that even if we're heading into a period of reform, we're heading into just another cycle of reform?
Is it a suspicion? It's a fear. Certainly, that's how the history of penal reform and retrenchment has happened in this country, that there have been periods of reform that gets to a certain point, and then we go back, and then we start back where we started from, and it happens all over again. I think if we step back a little further, we might be able to make change and break out of the cycle. Certainly now we have someone who claims to be a reformer, Commissioner Dennehy, as commissioner of the entire Department of Corrections, and that's very different. Before, it's always been a woman who's been in charge of just the woman's prison.
But you make this point nationally as well, that the difficulty that you had getting access, you'd have had the same trouble in any one of a number of states. This is not a Massachusetts phenomenon.
Absolutely correct. It's not. States across the nation, many of them have far more restrictive access than Massachusetts. In fact, Massachusetts falls pretty much in the middle. And again, the whole notion of reform is a nationwide issue because of the vast monies we're spending on it. People can't afford this prison boom anymore.
Can we have reform, though, without reforming mandatory minimums and the other sentencing issues that put so many people behind bars, or does that have to come first?
That has to come first.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like to join us on that, certainly there are people with perspectives on that from other states who we'll be talking to. I don't know, Christina, if the change that you see in Massachusetts is in any way being mirrored around the country. Is there, in the work that you did you hear of this? I mean, the woman in charge of San Quentin has talked about it, and I don't know if that's indicative of a larger cycle. What's your thought on that?
I think certainly California seems to be entering a period of reform, and nationwide, I don't think it's from an ideological shift that people are now seeking treatment for inmates rather than punishment. I don't think that's changed, and I think ultimately that's what needs to change for sustained change to occur. I think what's happening is far more pragmatic. We've tried this punishment thing for 25 years, it's cost us a fortune, and it hasn't worked. So now we're looking at reforming criminals instead. Let's see if that works.
1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join our conversation this hour. Christina Rathbone is my guest. Her new book is called A World Apart: Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Christina Rathbone is here with me in the studio. She's the author of a new book called A World Apart: Women, Prison, and Life Behind Bars. Her previous book, On the Outside Looking In, A Year at an Inner City High School, was an award-winning work about at-risk teenagers and their last chance high school in New York. This book tells stories of women who are inside prison, women who are getting out of prison, but generally about life for women behind bars. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to have you in. Next to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hello. I rode a horse at Angola. That's the largest prison, one of the largest prisons in the United States, in 1970. It was the most bloody. Today it's one of the safest. But there was no treatment there, and or the other prisons. We have about 13 prisons, and all of them are men except one female prison. And there's something that's really unusual. It's called goose picking. That's what they teach all of those prisoners. And when they get back out on the street, there are no jobs for goose picking.
You're going to have to tell me what goose picking is, David.
They make them bend over around fence areas and pick all the grass underneath the fence.
It's just total make work then.
That's all it is. Dig a ditch, move the dirt, and then dig another ditch and fill it up with the dirt. In other words, if we don't have a codified federal law, instead of leaving it up to the individual warden's personality and whim, we need to teach them vocational training of something like auto mechanics or carpenter work, something that they can go to work in any city in any state, a vocational trade that's for real. You know,
was it the warden then who made that call, David? The warden who had you out goose picking instead of going to class or learning something useful?
Well, I was riding a horse. I was actually working for the Department of Corrections.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
Okay.
I was riding a horse with a gun to shoot them if they would run.
Yeah.
And I was sitting on a horse thinking, what a waste of our resources and time. And this is my debate, and people never have an answer for this. If intelligent, hardworking people, family people, cannot quit smoking and they cannot quit drinking, we have a lot of that in our society, how can a third grader quit drugs? He's addicted to drugs. Here I am with a college degree, family person. You know, I have everything that society can offer. And if I and you cannot quit smoking or drinking, how do we expect a third grader from the projects in New Orleans to get off of drugs on his own?
Can I ask you a question, David? When you first started your work, did you feel this way? What was it that changed your mind about the way the prison system works today?
Well, I didn't know anything about the prison system before I went to work there besides what you read in the news media.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went to work in there, it's so completely different from what television and news media stories are. And once you actually get to know those guys and you put a face and a name and a life story, then you are not as prejudiced or a bigot toward inmates and convicts in general, and you realize, hey, this guy never had a chance from the day he was born. He did not have the same chance I had. And if everybody in prison was redheaded, let's dye their hair black. Well, everybody in prison has a third grade education. Let's teach them. Let's teach them education and vocational skills. But no, I don't know about up north, but down in the south, we have a very, you know, the majority of the prisons are black. So I would assume, you know, we built in prejudice. We say, well, we're not really going to help them or train them or teach them. They should know better.
David, I want to thank you for your call. And Christina, there's a point that David's making here which is very strongly reflected in your book. What's the waiting time for like a manicurist course at MCI Framingham? How easy is it for women to get into something that interests them while they're in prison?
Well, when I was there, the waiting list was about 10 months to get into the manicuring program. The manicuring program was closed down in 2002, I believe, completely. So that program just ceased to exist entirely. What the only new program I saw installed when I was there was at MCI Lancaster, and I believe this program has been moved to South Middlesex, though I'm not sure.
Because Lancaster closed.
Lancaster closed. Yeah. Was a very bizarre program designed for the women of MCI Lancaster, and it was an auto mechanic class. This was the former commissioner's own brainchild, apparently, and so it just got a green light all the way through, despite the fact that the women at MCI Lancaster could not have been less interested in becoming auto mechanics. Two women were enrolled in this program, which cost a lot of money to install, brand new garage, yeah, brand new equipment. And the women in the prison just laughed. It was just another example of the absurdity of the system that would design an auto mechanic class for the women of MCI Framingham instead of something that really would help them when they would get out.
And just picking up again on something else that David said about his experience at Angola, the women who would be in prison in Massachusetts, can they all get to college courses? How can they move their education ahead? There are pretty strict rules about that, aren't there?
There are. If you can get a GED if you go to prison, if you haven't graduated high school. There might be some waiting list, but you will get one eventually. And about half the women at MCI Framingham have not graduated high school. About 8% of the women have a little bit of college, and 3% of them, these are from 2004 DOC figures, have a college degree. Now, for that 8%, if you have some college, you can enroll in a BU program, actually, which is offered free of charge to the women. But if you have no college experience, which about 40%, about half of the women do not, there's no point taking a GED if you've graduated high school, and you cannot access university classes.
So even with a high school degree or diploma, you can't start a college course unless you've already been to college? What's
right.
the point in that?
Well, I mean, it's just a funding issue, I think. When I was there, you needed 16 credits, I believe, to start the program. And it's a great program, don't get me wrong. It's yeah. just, it doesn't get to all the women. Now I think they've reduced that to if you've completed three and passed three college classes that you can then access BU. But if you haven't, which most of them haven't, you can't. And so there you are for years and years under these mandatory sentencing rules, and you cannot get an education, and the job training you can get is either non-existent or auto mechanics, and then you're released, and you're really in a bad state. Now, to be fair, again, the commissioner, I interviewed her for a piece I did recently for The Globe, and she did say that she's committed to building up programming and education in the prison, and she had said she's bringing in a couple of serious new good programs to start in the fall, and that's a step in the right direction, a concrete step.
1-800-423-8255. Back to our callers to Petersburg, Iowa. Mike is joining us. Mike, you on the road?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Good. What are you thinking?
I'm thinking this is just a total reflection on the total failure of the drug war. I'm really upset about the war in Iraq. I'm upset about all the other abuses that have taken during that. But I don't think there's anything that has been as bad, as terrible as this war on drugs and how it's devastated. It was George Bush Sr. who started all these mandatory minimums and stuff like that, which has built up such a great population in our jails now, the first time ever, 2.1 million people in jail. I'm just so saddened how we're supposed to stand for freedom, and it's so far away from it. And our current president, we know that he's been an abuser of marijuana. We know he's been an abuser of alcohol. We know he's been an abuser of LSD.
We don't actually know any of that, in fairness to the president, Mike, but I think your point about the war on drugs is a key one, and it certainly shows up in the work that you're doing, Christina.
Yeah, it's certainly responsible for the mushrooming of the amount of people we have behind bars. And it is also significant that we have decided to punish rather than treat this You know, addiction has long been acknowledged as a sickness rather than any moral failing.
Well, tell us the story of Charlene Williams. I forget how old she is when she goes in. She's young, 21, 22, I think. She's arrested at 19?
She's arrested at 19. She's a 19-year-old young woman. She's in Boston. She's working and hanging out, just as many 19-year-olds are. And someone in an inner-city neighborhood here in Boston, and someone says to her, hey, why? I'll pay you $5,000 if you bring some drugs into the country. And this seems, she can't really believe that it's really true, and foolishly, without thinking about it, she agrees to it. And it's only when she's down in the Caribbean being confronted with these strange men who have drugs for her to bring in that she realizes this is really real. She, of course, decides she doesn't want to do it at that point. She's terrified. She's never done anything illegal before in her life. And at that point, it's also too late. There's just no way that a 19-year-old woman tells two drug dealers down in the Caribbean that she's changed her mind.
Well, because they've already paid to fly her down to the Caribbean.
Absolutely right.
That's the reason they own her at that point.
They own her, yeah. And these are frightening men. So she does it. She the whole flight back, she's torn between running to the bathroom and disposing of the drugs or carrying them through, and she's just too afraid. She knows there will be serious consequences if she just flushes thousands of dollars worth of drugs down the toilet. But she's not a professional criminal. She's terrified, and she's picked up, of course, immediately in Boston. She's not good at being cool and getting through customs. She looks a wreck, and she's arrested 15 years behind bars for her first very foolish mistake.
15 years.
15 years.
And it's a first offense?
First offense. Again, with mandatory sentencing laws, a judge can make no decisions about the individual case. First offense, the level that you're involved in the crime, even if you're the girlfriend of a man who stashed drugs under a bed, you will do the time depending on the amount of drugs involved. That's the only thing that's taken into consideration. And judge after judge after judge has come out and said, I am sickened by having to send these low-level drug dealers away for decades. It makes no sense, but the politicians in our country won't hear them and won't change it. There's still a fear of appearing to look soft on crime, even when everybody agrees this is absurd.
Back to our callers now to Waterloo, Iowa, and Mary's joining us. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just want to make a couple of comments, and this is very an emotional topic for me, but one, our government has determined that women should be treated differently in war, but not in this prison situation, which is totally absurd. And two, that it's also well known that male prisoners get more visits from their family and their children than females will ever get.
Is that just because of the family, or is that the rules that you're talking about, Mary?
No, I'm just talking about that the mothers of the children have more consideration of them being allowed to see their fathers than the fathers would have of taking their children to see their mothers.
And Christina, that's your experience as well?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, one sort of consequence of women being much fewer in prison is that when a man in certain communities goes to prison, it's almost an accepted rite of passage, and the mother of his children very often almost religiously brings the children to visit the man and maintains contact throughout the years. However, when a mother and a woman goes to prison, there is no wife or girlfriend there to bring the children to prison. She's the one in prison, and so visits are really reduced. In fact, I think it's about 60% of mothers across the nation say that they don't receive one visit from their kids in the whole time they're incarcerated, and there are many reasons for that, not just the lack of family to bring them, but because women are still a minority and because there's pretty much one prison for women in each state, the prisons are very far away from the kids and the costs are prohibitive just to get there.
Back to the lines to Greenfield, Massachusetts now. Allison's joining us. Hi, Allison.
Hi. I'm calling in. My mother has been in prison for 7 years, serving a mandatory 13-year sentence for a first-time drug offense. I guess I just really want to say that the focus really needs to be on reforming the mandatory drug laws.
How long has she got to serve, Allison? She's been in for seven. How many more years does she have to serve?
She has a minimum of 3 years and a maximum of 13. And when she was sentenced, the judge was very clear that he wished that he could give her 2 or 3 years, but his hands were tied, and there was just, he could have no discretion. And
is she at MCI Framingham?
Yes, she is.
Because I ask that, Allison, because Christina describes a pretty grim set of circumstances for people who want to visit women there. Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, it's been really awful. It's really hard to get down there. You wait forever. The visits are often cut off because of a, you know, high volume of visitors. Also, you know, I've had lost family members. My brother died last November, and my mother was allowed to come to wake when no one was there for 15 minutes, which was pretty much a traumatizing experience. It's awful.
And in prison, your mother, is she able to study at all? How does she pass her time?
She's actually is enrolled in the BU program, which is great. It took 7 years for her to be able to get into it. And as far as training for getting a job when she gets out, when she'll be 60, I mean, it really scares me. Like, I'm preparing myself to be taking care of her.
Christine, it's your experience that the women, when they get out, have a really hard time.
Oh, they do, and it's a subject, you know, for a whole other book, and there actually is a whole other book about it, written by Jennifer Gonneron. The programs that are not available in prison are similarly not available in the communities that the women return to. So they've spent years doing nothing, and quite apart from the psychological impact of that, I mean, certainly Denise, in my book, when she was released, couldn't cope even with going to a store. She'd been longing for fresh fruit and vegetables for 5 years, but when confronted with fresh fruit and vegetables, she panicked. Many women in prison for longer times than Denise have a really hard time just crossing the road. You haven't crossed a road in 5, 10, 15 years. You haven't driven a car. You haven't gone to the store, let alone had a job interview, managed to keep a job, managed to get your children back, managed to find housing. All of these things are incredibly difficult, especially if you've been incarcerated for a drug crime, because if you've been incarcerated for a drug crime, you're not eligible for a number of the different welfare packages, and you're not eligible for a number of different housing subsidies. And so a life that is already really hard is made close to impossible by just a lack of provision. So that is something else that really, really needs looking into.
And Alison, that's going to be the case for your mother as well, is that right?
Oh, yes, definitely.
If you could wish one wish about the situation or the circumstances for women prisons, Alison, what would it be?
I just wish that there was some way that she could get out before she's completely, you know, destroyed. She's not going to be the same person when she comes out, and I, you know, try to be hopeful, but I, you know, my feeling is that she's probably not going to be able to find a job where she can support herself. And you know, so much time has gone by. I'm 24 years old. I've, you know, graduated from college. I'm in graduate school. My brother's passed. I just wish that she could get out before it's kind of too late for her, because it's going to be, I can't imagine her adjusting back into society.
Alison, I thank you for your call. And Christina Rathbone, I thank you for coming in and helping us with a conversation about women in prison with your new book, A World Apart. It was nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.